This is the second year that Dr. John Marciano has led a popular study group considering Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States. Dr. Marciano is Emeritus Professor, State University of New York, where he taught courses on social and historical foundations of education and class, gender, and race. In 2004, he began the series at the now-departed Midnight Special Bookstore in Santa Monica. The series now continues at the Venice United Methodist Church Peace Center. Every month, this group meets to discuss the assigned reading, individual chapters in People's History. To join the group, contact Dr. Marciano at 310-393-4815 or John Marciano at macmac.com. The LA Sound Posse records and publishes Creative Commons licensed talks and events such as this and can be reached at lasoundposse.org. The contact information will be repeated at the end of the recording. The following recording by the LA Sound Posse substitutes for the January 17th of 2006 recording. It was done on November 30th of 2004 and covers the same chapters: 20, the 70s, Under Control, and 21, Carter, Reagan, Bush, the Bipartisan Consensus.
Okay, talking about chapters 20 and 21, the 70s, Under Control, and Carter, Reagan, Bush, the Bipartisan Consensus. I'm sure some of this material, especially the discussion of the 70s and the demise of Richard Nixon, the short presidency of Gerry Ford, Watergate, Jimmy Carter, Reagan, on to Reagan and the Bush. Bush won. We'll bring back tears of nostalgia to us all. I'm sure that those of us who are old enough to remember were probably glued to the television sets. I guess it was July or August 73 when the House Judiciary Committee started its discussion of impeachment proceedings. I remember I had a graduate class and we watched that opening session, and then Nixon finally resigning in August 74. So thinking back to that time 30 years ago, 1974, the Vietnam War still going on. As Zinn tells us, widespread discontent with the political system, of course, a tremendous falling off in the faith that people had in government and other major institutions, a deep sense of distrust with those running the country, the great divide in the country over Vietnam, and of course the rise of Watergate and the demise of Nixon, who of course resigned in August 74 rather than face a sure impeachment conviction in the Congress, which would have made the first in U.S. history. And as we should recall, that the articles of impeachment dealt primarily with Watergate, cover-up, those kinds of things, but said nothing about the illegal war in Southeast Asia, nothing about the bombing of Cambodia. And for those, of course, who recall that time and recall working for George McGovern against Nixon in 72, and recall that Nixon did have a mandate, unlike the current president, Nixon absolutely smashed McGovern in November 1972, won every state but Massachusetts. I remember young people at my college who worked on the McGovern campaign crying in our living room. They had really poured their hearts out in this small town in upstate New York, Cortland, New York, which carried on a tradition that it had carried on since the Republican Party started by voting Republican again, I think in almost every election since the party began in 1860. Zinn tries to remind us that, of course, that the real issue around Nixon was getting rid of a bad apple, but maintaining the legitimacy of the system, to make sure that people did not dig deeper into the underlying assumptions and practices of the warfare state, the support of corporations, the CIA involvement in Chile and elsewhere. And of course, he's going to argue that Gerry Ford and Jimmy Carter worked very hard to restore our faith in the system, which is an absolutely critical point, which is why the New York Times said the system is working. So Nixon chooses Ford, and we know they had some quid pro quo. Ford then turns around and pardons Nixon, and you'll remember that scene where, you know, Nixon leaving the White House, getting onto the helicopter and coming out. Zinn quotes the French editor of Le Monde, who put this in a much better perspective: the elimination of Nixon leaves intact all the mechanisms and false values which permitted the Watergate scandal. All of the policies would continue. Kissinger, of course, Henry the K, as I used to call him, would lead foreign policy. Washington, of course, would continue to support the generals in Chile and Brazil and Paraguay. The argument being that Nixon had to be sacrificed in order to maintain the legitimacy of the system itself. Corrupt individuals can be dumped, including presidents, all right? But the policies have to continue. That's the important thing. You can shift people around, and it shows you how deep the legitimacy of this system is. Because the big concern was not about the crimes, and the crimes around Watergate were pretty small potatoes, given what was actually going on, that we found out later with the Church Committee and other things. As we said, the bombing of Cambodia, which of course the Cambodians knew about, so the secret was to keep it from the American people. The involvement of the United States in the overthrow of the Allende government in Chile, and all sorts of other activities which did come to the surface during the Church Committee hearings. But the Judiciary Committee of the House of Representatives, which of course did not want to be placed in the public limelight, having to discuss the possible impeachment. The House brings impeachment, the Senate then votes on conviction, up or down. They did not want to have this at all. And they clearly did not want to touch Nixon's illegal dealings with U.S. corporations, the CIA and other countries, the bombing of Cambodia. So they concentrated on him. And I think Zinn is correct when he says, get rid of Nixon, but keep the system. And on this score, those in power were helped by the mass media, by educators, clergy, sort of national intellectuals, all of whom sort of got behind the effort to restore, it was almost like a counter-revolution, that is to try to undermine people's distrust of the government, which had been growing since the late 50s and especially exploded in the 60s and early 70s. The key was to change people's perceptions of the policies, not to change the policies, to change the consciousness about what is going on, not what is actually going on. You keep the premises of the system intact, and I would argue the premises have been intact, even though we've had different administrations, even though we've had more conservative, somewhat liberal administrations. If you think of perhaps on the most liberal end, FDR, and on the most conservative end, who would know? It's hard because we've had some really extraordinary reactionary presidents. But the premises of the system itself have really been intact since the founding of the country. So the establishment cleansed itself. You know, they slapped some wrists on some of these guys. A number of them got, you know, small fines. A few of them actually went to prison. I mean, they really went to country club prisons. I mean, they didn't go to Attica in upstate New York, where the Attica revolt happened in 1971. When 41 people were killed by the New York State Police. You know, they did community service, those kinds of things. So you have this process underway, tremendous coverage on every little detail about Watergate and the break-in and this and that, and when Nixon told John Dean, remember all those hearings, John Dean is testifying, and then I forget the guy, Frederick somebody, who dropped the bomb saying, oh, yeah. Butterfield, yeah, and who just dropped the bomb that, oh yeah, the president, yeah, used to be taping things. And, you know, we found out all sorts of things. I mean, Alexander, you know, Butterfield. Alexander Butterfield. See, this guy's done his homework. Now he's going to send him home with a 3 stars. And of course, we got some of the substantive comments from Nixon and also some of his incredible racist, anti-Semitic comments. I mean, he really was a pretty nasty, vicious guy when it came to talking about people. So all the details about Watergate, but not as much putting things under the microscope, for example, about My Lai, Cambodia, the FBI and the CIA involved in programs to go after the Black Panthers, socialists, anti-war activists, etc. Ford, of course, short period of time. The Ford presidency essentially is going to continue the policies, Nixon's policies. Ford desperately trying to prop up the Thieu regime in Vietnam. It did not work. And as we discussed last time, the Vietnamese finally threw out the U.S. On April 30th, 1975. There were some U.S. forces there, making that the first time since the mid-1800s that foreign aggressors had been not on Vietnamese soil. So imperialism continued, the exploitation of poor nations continued, things were going on in the country. After the war, of course, with Ford and then Carter, the worry of those in power would be, and we discussed this last month, was what would happen with the lessons of the Vietnam War, the lessons of the 60s and the 70s, the lessons of the Church Committee and the U.S. interfering in every single country and movement in the world that tried to extricate itself from the international capitalist orbit. You cannot name a single place on the planet in the 20th century that did not happen. Okay, you can see, you want to start with the Bolshevik Revolution, you want to talk about the Congo, you want to talk about Iran, you want to talk about Laos, you want to talk about Cambodia, you want to talk about Nicaragua. You could throw a dart at the globe, wherever it landed, the U.S. was sure to be involved. So in Cuba for 40 plus years now. So the lessons of what had happened were critical. And part of the process that Zinn discusses is, how do you restore? It's a restoration of the ruling elite views of what happened in that war and what happened elsewhere in the world in order to undermine the deep distrust of U.S. leaders that the population had revealed in various polls. And remember, given the educational process that we've all gone through in schools, in churches or synagogues, in the mass media, we essentially were raised, all of us, to trust, for the most part, those in power. So it took extraordinary events to erode that trust. And so the effort from the mid-70s on is to begin, and this involves not just Republicans, but involves Democrats as well. It involved Ford, it involved Carter, and it involved trying to get the Congress of the United States in order to sort of put Humpty Dumpty back together again so that policies could go on as before. This happened even though there was a genuine shock in the country at the revelations of the Church Committee, which released its findings in 1976, Senator Frank Church of Idaho. That is the CIA involvement in plots to kill Castro, to introduce swine fever into Cuba, to work against the Chilean government, the connections that helped to eventually lead to the assassination of Patrice Lumumba in what was formerly Belgian Congo, the involvement of the U.S. in supporting South Africa, the involvement of the U.S. in wars to prop up the Portuguese colonial regime, and then the U.S. wars, U.S. supporting South Africa and its wars against Namibia, Angola, etc. And the facts that we found out that the CIA had subsidized literally thousands of books and articles, planting stories, and there were all sorts of journalists, all sorts of groups that were on the CIA payroll. But as far as I can recall from my research, not a single person named by the Church Committee ended up spending any time in prison. I think Richard Helms pleaded guilty to some lesser charge, again, got some kind of a fine. So all of these activities, which, by the way, ended up, if you add Philip Agee, who used to be with the CIA, argued that at some point in the, he had a book came out in the early, mid-80s, that he estimated that roughly 6 million people had been killed between 1947, the formation of the CIA, and the mid-80s in various wars around the world, and he included Vietnam in that.
I was just, John, I was just listening to a tape of an interview that Dave did with a Korean woman. She was estimating 5 million people in Korea alone.
Yeah, so it's even even higher than Philip Agee mentioned.
There were over 3,000 minor incursions in the covert actions, and not over 900 major ones. And of course, the minor ones could be a little village where they killed everybody.
Right.
And of course, Church was beaten in the next election. The Republicans spent a lot of money being sure he got beaten.
Right, right. Yeah, he was one of those Democrat, mild, sort of centrist liberals who lost in 1980, and he was one of them, yeah. At that time, then the Republicans took the Senate in 1980 for the first time since the Eisenhower era in 1954, yeah.
As long as you mention Philip Agee's name, I'm happy to report that Philip is alive and well. He lives in Havana, Cuba, and he has a website where he's encouraging tourism to Cuba. So if you're very interested, you can find his website by Google the search. A-G-E-E is, I think, the spelling. He continues to be a wanted criminal by the U.S. Justice Department. And under what conditions he could return is another question, but hopefully there's negotiations going on about that.
Well, thank you, Jay. Jay and Rachel were just in Cuba. One of the more than an irony of history that Philip Agee, who blew the whistle on the murders and the deception and the lies, has been a wanted man for decades and unable, of course, to come back to the United States. He had to leave the United States. And the people who actually did the murdering and the pillaging and the slaughtering and the torturing, you know, wrote books and got TV shows and talk shows and have been thought of as being statesmen. The number one, of course, Henry Kissinger. In fact, there was a line in one of Joseph Heller, the author of Catch-22, in one of his later books. There's a line, something, if there was justice in the world, the character who was modeled after Kissinger would have been walking at Spandau, the prison in Germany, with, I guess, the Russians had Rudolf Hess, and that the two of them would have been walking and chatting, you know, maybe sharing recipes or something. But when you look at Kissinger's record, I mean, if you look at it very, very carefully, we're talking about one of the really arch terrorists of the modern time. And he ended up, of course, sharing the Nobel Prize for Peace with Lee Dak Tho after the Vietnam War. So we have a counterattack in this beginning in the 70s. It's hard to place the exact time. In the early 70s, and I'm blanking on his last name, Lewis, Supreme Court Justice. Come on, folks, help me here. He was in the court in the early 70s. Made a speech to a business group absolutely decrying what had happened in the 60s and early 70s, that there was absolutely no faith in government, there was no faith in business. A number of people associated with that period as the beginning of the counterattack. I sort of associate it with Samuel Blowtorch Huntington, who got that name. He was a Harvard professor. He may still be on the faculty at Harvard. He's written another tome about the clash of civilizations between Islam and the West. He was an advisor of the Pentagon. He got that name, Blowtorch Huntington, because he was the author of what was called the forced urbanization theory in Vietnam, which is if you want to defeat the guerrillas in Vietnam, what you do is absolutely devastate and bomb every square inch of the rural areas of Vietnam, and you will drive all the people into the cities. So you will literally take the people away from the guerrillas. He wrote an essay called The Crisis of Democracy, 1975. It's in a book, and it was written for the Trilateral Commission, in which he argues, as did William Simon also, that Zinn discusses, that there'd been such an upsurge of what Huntington called democratic distemper. I guess you'd have to have a rabies shot or something against it. Students, before that, blacks in the South and Latinos and students, an anti-war movement, the gay movement, the environmental movement, all of these movements disrupting the ability of the governing elites to be able to run the country the way they used to. And Huntington refers back to the time of Truman, when Truman could literally sit around with a few people like Dean Acheson and Clark Clifford and just a few guys, and they were all guys, and they were all white, and they were all wealthy, and they basically made decisions, and then they would sort of try to get Congress to go along with it. So this campaign, which gets tremendous financial support beginning in the 70s from the emerging think tanks, gets money from the Coors family, gets money from the Bradley Foundation in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. You should see the layout they've got. They've got about a $5 million mansion in Milwaukee, in a gorgeous area of Milwaukee with about 29 satellites on the roof. The Bradley Foundation has pumped a lot of money into the American Enterprise Institute, Heritage, etc. And these folks got together. It wasn't a cabal and wasn't a conspiracy, though from the Latin to conspire meant to breathe together, and these folks do breathe together, to try to undo what happened, the positive things of the 60s and 70s, and in the longer range, to undo the positive things from the Depression and the New Deal in order to make sure that they could restore the power of the elite to do what it's supposed to do, and especially the power of the president. And I think Zinn argues, and I would support this argument, that the last 30 years, since, if we use Huntington's article as a starting off point, 1975, the last 30 years been a very sustained effort, and that includes university intellectuals, especially the mass media, to restore the role of the imperial presidency to the place it was under Roosevelt, especially under Truman, under Eisenhower, even under Kennedy, and under Johnson before things started to unravel. And this effort has been helped by not just conservatives and Republicans, but also by liberals and Democrats. This is a bipartisan effort, and if you look very carefully at the fundamental assumptions that guide this country, there are differences between the two parties, as we saw emerge in the recent election. But when it comes to the imperial presidency, when it comes to the U.S. essentially being the chosen nation, the U.S. being the empire, everyone is red, white, and blue. And this was also helped by the formation of the Trilateral Commission, put together by David Rockefeller, with Zbigniew Brzezinski. He was the director of the Trilateral Commission. He then became Jimmy Carter's national security advisor. And the Trilateralists included some of the top industrialists and financiers from the Western Europe, Japan, Australia, and the United States, and included some labor leaders and big shot intellectuals. And it's the Trilateralists, by the way, who gave us James Earl Carter as president. I mean, who ever heard of Jimmy Carter, all right? Governor of Georgia, Plains, Georgia. Who the hell ever heard of Plains, Georgia before Carter emerged on the scene out of nowhere? Another Southern, in a sense, it's some similarities about how we ended up with Billy Clinton. So you've got Carter, I mean, part of this next chapter, the Carter-Reagan-Bush bipartisan consensus is built on the assumption that there are certain givens in the system, private property, the economic virtues of capitalism, nationalism, the U.S. always doing good in the world. And that's the given, and within that given, of course, there are differences, but the givens are never examined. So we ended up in the Trilateralist with Jimmy Carter, just a plain old down-home guy who was happened to be a millionaire before he, you know, just found, you know, those few dollars here and there as a peanut farmer, another millionaire. The rhetoric and the reality of Jimmy Carter, who's gone on to do some actually very commendable things since he left the presidency, Habitat for Humanity, trying to negotiate and mediate conflicts around the world, but his role as president has been subjected to an amazing amount of spin. And I don't mean the usual things that Carter, you know, Carter was blamed for the tremendous inflation at that time. But his job was to help, and I think that's why the Trilateralists pushed him, to restore faith in the system damaged by Vietnam and Watergate. And especially the extraordinary spin around Jimmy Carter's policies about human rights, okay. Now, on a number of areas, Carter's policies were not as blatant and brutal as the gentleman from California, Ronald Reagan, who followed Carter to the presidency. But if we look at the actual policies, under the Carter administration, as opposed to our wishful fantasies about those policies. You want to try the Shah of Iran? You want to try Nicaragua? You want to look at Southern Africa? You want to look at the invasion by Indonesia into East Timor, in which Jimmy Carter's secretary at the United Nations, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, later senator of my Empire State when I lived there, who bragged in his memoirs that he was given the task of making sure that the United Nations was not going to do anything about what happened in East Timor, and he did it very, very successfully. And it was one of the great slaughters since World War II. And Afghanistan. We now know from Brzezinski's comments that 6 months before the Soviets came into Afghanistan, the United States CIA began arming the Mujahideen, the fundamentalists, of course, that then brought blowback to the United States. There's a marvelous book by Chalmers Johnson on that. And, of course, closer to home, I mentioned Nicaragua. Carter, right till the end, was trying to work out a deal to make sure that the Sandinistas did not end up in power in Nicaragua. And despite a personal appeal from Bishop Oscar Romero in El Salvador, who was later assassinated, Carter actually supported some minimal arms shipments to the regime in El Salvador. And Carter was a supporter of and sympathizer of the Vietnam War, and while governor of Georgia, declared a support Rusty Cali Day, in which people were supposed to drive around Georgia with their lights on in support of little Rusty Cali of My Lai fame when Rusty was under house arrest in Georgia. And if you recall from the My Lai massacre, he's the only one who, quote unquote, did any time. He was under house arrest. No one else spent a day. And I mean, the only shocking thing about My Lai is that it's the most publicized massacre of the Vietnam War. It was not unique, by the way, because that was a fact part of the Rolling Thunder campaign, and that was happening all over that sector. And in fact, just a couple of miles away in San Mai, another small village, there was a massacre the very same day as My Lai that never even made the press. And one last comment on that, the beginning of the cover-up of the My Lai massacre was initiated by none other than probably the most respected American, Colin Powell, who was then Major Colin Powell, United States Army AmeriCal Division, who was asked to investigate the massacre, and he came up with the conclusion that, yes, there have been some incidents here and there, but the relationship between the Vietnamese and the Americans were generally excellent. I mean, how anybody could miss that one is beyond me.
Just wanted to add one other thing. According to Dan Ellsberg, Carter was the first American president to put on paper the American right to nuclear first strike. Wow. PD-51, I think it was.
Wow, I didn't even know that. Yeah, first strike, relegating to ourselves. Of course, then the Carter Doctrine in the Middle East. I mean, it's a lot of this, of course, is laid at the foot of Reagan. You know, the Reagan came in, I mean, we had all this concern for human rights, and then Reagan came in and he was terrible and he didn't know. The Middle East from the Far East, but Carter has come off smelling like a rose in terms of his policies. And of course, he surrounded himself with a lot of Cold War ideologues like Brzezinski and the old corporate guard. And Carter began, he started under Ford, but Carter began and continued what was to be a 20-year embargo and economic war against Vietnam, something we discussed last time, in which he said that, of course, we didn't owe any reparations to Vietnam because the destruction was mutual. As Noam Chomsky said, surely one of the most breathtaking diplomatic statements in history.
Three comments on Carter just for a moment. One is the issue of Rhodesia, which, if you recall, he sent the mayor of Atlanta, Andrew Young, to Rhodesia to negotiate with Jan Smith for a peaceful transition of power to the new government, Mugabe, who is in power to this very day, a socialist, a progressive. There's some debate about Mugabe as you get into the details, of course. But the principle at the time was a peaceful transition of power in Rhodesia to Zimbabwe, a new name for the country, to majority control by the vast majority of the black folks in the country, and taking away, in effect, the power of the white minority. So I think that when we're judging Jimmy Carter, we should look at some of his positive accomplishments, that being one of them. The other being the opening of transportation to Cuba for a two-year period. He permitted flights to go from U.S. soil to Cuba direct. We were on the first one, out of Chicago, as for that matter, for a two-year period. And the third was the issue in Guatemala, where he forbade any shipments of weapons from the U.S. to Guatemala, which we found out later was simply substituted by Israel, providing the exact same weapons through the other door at the same time. But Carter did have some good things to say about him, just like Nixon did wage price controls. So there, when we're balancing these things, I think we have to put both on the table.
And Carter, of course, by doing some of the things, as you mentioned, in Guatemala, something that will continue past Carter, is that especially the U.S. uses Israel as a surrogate, especially in Central America, to train the Contras and to train the death squads.
I think the most lasting element of the Carter presidency, which is with us to this very day, was your comment on Zbigniew Brzezinski and the training of the Mujahideen and the setting up of the schools in Pakistan to train the Mujahideen, in which Osama bin Laden and that whole crew was part of that. In the name of fighting communism in Kabul, it turned out to being what we know today as the groups that have been so-called doing the attacks on the United States. Yeah. So that legacy is directly from Carter.
Yeah. That's what Chalmers Johnson means by blowback, and we ended up helping to train people who then were instrumental in not just the attacks and 9/11.
Yeah, I was just going to add to that. As I understand it, I don't know how much time was it before the covert action over there in Afghanistan, that they were actually went across the border and irritated the Soviets so that they came in, and then you saw these headlines, Soviet Union attacks Kabul or Afghanistan or whatever it is. And that's what the CIA wanted. And then it was the excuse for the U.S. to go in and do what it did and use all these warlords. The excuse was they're going to drive out godless communism. So they had people there who were like the Taliban kind of people, right? And that's where Osama bin Laden got his training and where all those kind of people started out.
And again, not to defend the Soviet Union in Afghanistan or other countries in terms of foreign policy issues. But from Brzezinski's perspective, it was to try to suck in the Soviet Union into a war the way the U.S. had been supposedly sucked in Vietnam. That is literally to bleed the Soviets and to grind them down, which is what happened, and leaving that country, Afghanistan, absolutely devastated. Poverty-stricken, and then continuing, of course, now into the war on terror, where you've got, let's see, so we're talking from late 79, 80, talking 20, 25 years of constant war in a country where now our man in Afghanistan essentially controls a few blocks in Kabul with the U.S. bodyguard. And as the New York Times reported, the opium crop in Afghanistan broke all records, by the way. A lot of it goes to Western Europe. Places like Norway, actually Times said a long article on the heroin problems in Norway, of all places.
Didn't Carter negotiate to turn over the Panama Canal?
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes these presidents do these things knowing that a future, you know, to look good, and the delivery date is at some point in the future, knowing that a future president will probably ram something else through and turn it back the way it was. I don't necessarily put that down as an unblemished plus, but it is something, I guess.
Yeah, and its time had come to the point where actually John Wayne, of all people, got up and attacked other right-wingers who were attacking Carter because they were upset that we were giving away the Panama Canal. And Wayne supported us giving away the canal back to these... Right, we stole it fair and square. Okay, I don't want to take too much more time. The Reagan and Bush years, the wonderful 80s. Just a personal note. In 1984, I was on an exchange in the Soviet Union. I was living at Moscow State University with a friend for 4 months, And we were there during the election campaign, Reagan against Mondale. And loads and loads of not just Soviets, I mean, it was like the United Nations in this dorm. People kept coming up because we had a big anti-Reagan poster on our door and wanted to talk about the election. And of course, I couldn't get any news, and it borrowed someone's little shortwave radio the morning after the election, trying to find out. I mean, I assumed by then, you know, that Reagan was going to win. He was going to stomp Mondale, which he did. So that's where I was in 1984. And of course, then we had to spend a lot of time talking to the Soviets, who in that four-month period were absolutely, totally, I mean, it was like this almost schizophrenic thing. Everybody loved us. They loved all the Americans in our program. I mean, they invited you to places. I mean, we were supposed to have vodka at noon at meetings. And they were like my Italian relatives. I mean, they were kissing you, hugging you, grabbing you. But they were deathly, deathly, absolutely, totally frightened, terrified of Reagan and the U.S. government. And virtually everyone we talked with who was older had lost someone in World War II. All right, and they said, we know war. And it hit us when the day after Christmas, December 26, 1984, we were at the National Cemetery outside of then Leningrad. You go way out, and it was a dark, miserable, cold day. Leningrad, it's dark in Leningrad around the shortest time of year, believe me. I mean, it was dark till 10 in the morning, then it was dark at 3 in the afternoon. A million people are in this cemetery in mounds that just have a year because they didn't have time during the siege of Leningrad, where more than a million people died, to bury people. And we were there, and it was an amazingly emotional day. And my friend said, I wonder what it must be like for Germans who come to this cemetery. And we walk up, and there's a big monument, and there was a wreath of flowers from a German group, peace group, you know, in remembrance. And it was pretty.
That was the Plain of Mars, I think, is the name of that cemetery. And each one is a mound of 500 bodies in a square section. And there's square after square.
Right. And trees,
after square,
and it goes from
as
miles.
Far as you can see.
Right.
It's hard to comprehend.
And it's an absolutely, and especially given the nature of the day, an over emotionally, just absolutely overwhelming feeling. And then, you know, having read about the siege of Leningrad in Alexander Wirth's wonderful book, Russia at War, and then the book 900 Days, but to be there and to talk, and you could feel it in the streets of Leningrad as you did not feel in Moscow, which was not attacked directly. The Nazi armies got within about 20 miles from Moscow. So remember the early 80s, the evil empire, the increased attacks on the USSR and other countries, massive involvement in Afghanistan, of course, support for South Africa and their wars there, huge jump in the military budget, tremendous tax cuts, of course, for the rich, massive cuts in social programs in order to pay for the tremendous rise in military spending. Charles and I and Taraj, who's not here, were taking an American Economic History course at UCLA Extension, and we just happened to discuss this last night. I mean, the greatest raid on the U.S. Treasury in history during the Reagan years. I mean, the debt went just absolutely up through the ceiling, through the roof, into the trillions. The greatest debt accumulation over every single president before that in history. And we're still living with that. And now, of course, it's gone up another $2 trillion under Bush. We're up to about $8.2 trillion. It's important to note, as Zinn does, and as Kevin Phillips, conservative Republican who's had a number of fine books, one of them called Wealth and Democracy, and the other one called The Bush Dynasty, which is a brilliant book on the Bush family, that these programs, the Reagan Revolution, was not just put through by the Republicans, but also by some Democrats as well. You got the Reagan Democrats. I love Phillips' comment that the Democratic Party was history's second most enthusiastic capitalist party. We know what happened. The real victors of the Reagan and Bush era were the rich, who benefited from tax cuts and massive subsidies, welfare. I mean, the biggest welfare bums on the planet, and Reagan was going around talking about welfare queens. That, of course, used to make a big impact on my students who would want to tell me about all the welfare people, especially black people who were driving around in Cadillacs. They based that on a theory of one. There actually was one African American in Cortland who was head of the Equal Opportunity Program, a friend of mine, Tommy Newkirk, who happened to be African American, who grew up in Harlem. And when he moved to Cortland, he was about the only black person in that community, and he actually loved to drive around with a white Cadillac convertible with a cowboy hat deliberately to make sure that white folks in Cortland got the message. But my students would end up taking, you know, they had heard of somebody who was on welfare who did this and did that, and the idea of trying to get them to understand that trillions was being stolen simply didn't work, okay? Even though there was an understanding then when they polled people, and there is an understanding now in the populace, though it's not organized and is not a revolt, that people do know the tax system is unfair and basically is there for the rich and not for average working folks. Every single poll that I've seen since the 60s, people understand this, that the system is not run for people like them. But they're not out in the streets, as my paisani in Italy evidently are out. There's another, I don't know, general strike. I mean, the Italians are always ready to get out in the streets, but we should take a lesson from them. So you have a huge shift in funds during the Reagan era. Kevin Phillips has discussed this in Wealth and Democracy, especially the funds to the military and the rich from the middle and lower classes. As I said, supported by both parties, and especially when it came to foreign policy. And that was shown even though the Congress of the United States passed the Boland Amendment about trying to block money to the Contras in Nicaragua. Later on, money was passed by Congress above board to help undermine the Sandinistas there. And we're all well aware of the amazing lines and machinations of selling arms to Iran, and the Israelis were involved in getting money and drug money in order to get it back to the Contras. One of the people, of course, one of my favorite people again to go back to, Colin Powell, of course, was involved in Iran-Contra. He was the aide to Pentagon boss Caspar Weinberger. When asked about his involvement in Iran-Contra during a congressional hearing, Colin Powell said 59 times, "I do not recall." Okay? And then he was the one that supposedly urged Bush to pardon Weinberger because a lot of issues would have come up, especially after the invasion of Panama. And as with sort of the gloss we got about Jimmy Carter, I think the gloss in many ways about Powell is even greater. Powell was Reagan's national security advisor when the U.S. was involved in wars against Southern Africa. The list goes on and on and on. And of course, in the 80s, under Reagan, in order to flex our muscles in the world, especially after the Marines were killed in Lebanon, right after, or I think it was a few days later, the U.S. invaded Grenada, as you know, to rescue those poor, helpless medical students who were never in danger, and in the battle against 57 Cuban technicians and a few Grenadians, I think there was something like 9,000 medals awarded. You know, Grenada, El Salvador, Guatemala, Panama, of course, you remember we had to go in and get that big dope fiend, Noriega, who, of course, was on the take with the CIA for years. We may forget that big-time liberals like Kennedy and Kerry supported the invasion of Panama. And on to George Bush, King George I, the famous Persian Gulf War, in which the President of the United States manages to move 500,000 troops in place before there's even a discussion in Congress, which led, of course, to a resolution on the war, which passed. Remember, it was not a declaration of war as mandated by the Constitution of the United States. Article 1, Section 8, Congress shall declare war. It doesn't say Congress shall declare resolution. All right, the war was an illegal and unconstitutional atrocity. Perhaps 200,000 Iraqis died during the actual war, the 100-day war. 143 actual combat U.S. deaths, of which 38 were killed by their own troops, friendly fire. Hundreds of thousands of American GIs have filed for benefits, by the way, since returning from the Iraq War. It's almost actually half of those who served there. Hundreds of thousands of Iraqis, mostly children, would die because of the U.S. sanctions that were put in place in 1990, pushed by the U.S. And it must be noted, when we talk about different presidents, that more Iraqis, and most of those disproportionately are children, more Iraqis died during William Jefferson Clinton's presidency than died in both Gulf Wars under the Bushes. So when we get angry at George Bush the one and George Bush the two, we need to remember that the sanctions have gone on. They have been lifted, but they went on from August 1990 until the war ended. You remember this war ended in April 2003, and there was rarely a peep in the United States Congress from Republicans or Democrats during that time, and not a peep from those supposed anti-war nasty nations like Germany and those pathetic French who were always against the United States. The French did not oppose the sanctions. Okay, let's take a break.
There was nothing in here about the Livermore Action thing that Deirdre and I were involved in between 80 and 85. And, you know, we had sometimes 2,000 people being arrested out at the Livermore Labs in Livermore outside of Berkeley. I guess it's just something Zinn overlooked. The other thing is, this is a book called The Land of Orange Groves and Jails, and it's actually about the life of Upton Sinclair and his campaign against poverty and run for governorship here in California. And it's edited by a friend of ours, Lauren Cooley. And this book sort of grew out of a project that we did a number of years ago at UCLA. We had a conference, and we had Upton Sinclair scholars come. I'm plugging it because it's my friend's book, but it's actually a very, very good read. And since we're all interested in history, this is California history that we all need to know. And I highly recommend this book. It's called The Land of Orange Groves and Jails by Lauren Cooley, Upton Sinclair's California.
I watch Huell Hauser all the time. I wonder if he's going to do a program on Upton Sinclair. Oh, gosh, golly.
Yeah,
I mean, no, I love his program. I learn all these things about California. I'm new here, man, I tell you. He's got the best job. I mean, this guy's, what, are you kidding? I would love to have that job. Let's open it up. It's Nixon and Ford and Carter and the Reagan-Bush era. There's lots to talk about. Yes?
I'd like to start off with a comment about Carter again. I spent a year in Iran in 69 and went back again in 78. And Carter apparently had been leaning on the Shah. The way I heard it was telling the Shah, you're giving us in the U.S. a bad name for supporting you. You're being such a dictator. What we need is for you to get real democratic and open up the society. So when I went back for 1 month, got there in about the 1st of June, and apparently the pressures of Carter had worked, and the Shah had declared that now any people who want to gather in the streets to have a demonstration or to publish, sell, or buy books that had been on the taboo list, et cetera, speak your mind, et cetera, no problem. The SOVAK will not come after you and drag you off to be tortured in the Shah's prisons. So for 1 month, everything was open and free. When I got there, I couldn't believe it. The things you could find in bookstores and so forth, people selling cassettes of talks on the street. 4 days after I left, apparently the Shah decided he'd had enough of the experiment and clamped down. 4 days after I left, I was en route back to the U.S. And when I got the news of the burning of the Cinema Rex, a working small movie theater in the south of Iran, Abadan, I think it was, in the working class part of town, used to show films that dealt with working class issues. People during this period, believing the Shah, were beginning to show more radical films. The theater was full. The police were ordered to chain the theater shut from the outside and set fire to it. 300 people died in that fire. And that was the beginning of the end. There's a tradition in Muslim countries that 40 days after someone's death, you hold a memorial. And so 40 days after the burning of Cinema Rex, around the country, five or six places around the country, there were demonstrations honoring the dead. And the Shah's troops came out and shot people down. And so 40 days after that, There were about 100 places around the country where demonstrations, and the troops came out and shot people there. And that was the beginning of the end of the Shah. So Carter set it off. That's all I wanted to say about Carter.
So this was unfolding before often they see the triggering point in the U.S. as when he allowed the Shah to come to the U.S. for treatment. Mm-hmm. Things were happening.
Yeah, Carter set it in motion much sooner, much earlier than that.
Just to add to that, I don't know if people know about this, but when they originally went over there and wanted to overthrow things, I forget what year was it, 53 or
53.
Something? Or seven,
they
53. Seven. So they could get the oil. The CIA person that went over there was a cousin of Theodore Roosevelt or something like that, a nephew or something
Kermit
like
Roosevelt.
That. And there's somebody that's written a book about this, and it's really incredible. It's like he went over there and paid gangs and thugs and people to go out and do all kinds of things and blame things on people and do this and do that and do that. And it was like one of the first covert CIA actions that was really planned like that to subvert a government, and it worked. It worked really well.
Yeah. All the Shah's Men, I think, is the name.
Is that by the same guy, Stephen Kinzer, who did this book on Guatemala? Yeah, because the year after was the coup in Guatemala. Actually, one of the first involvement of the CIA, their first involvement was not in the Middle East, but in Europe, in which they helped destabilize the Italian elections by pumping a lot of money into the Christian Democrats, of course, to make sure the communists
and
Greece, and then Italy to make sure the communists didn't win, getting lots of a real campaign here in the U.S. to get, not directed by the CIA, but by others, to get untold thousands and thousands of Italian Americans here in the United States to write to their relatives in Italy to make sure that they voted for the Christian Democrats in that period, and in France. And
going back to Iran, the Shah of Iran was ill, and the pressure that was put on Carter to allow him to come to the States to get treatment was put on by Henry Kissinger and David Rockefeller personally, and they must have read him the Riot Act at that time, and then the Shah came here.
The period of time in the 53, when we refer back to the overthrow of Mossadegh in Iran, was just an outgrowth of what was then called the Central Intelligence Agency, but prior to that was called the Office of Strategic Services, the OSS, operating in World War II, of which my father happened to be a member of that, which is a whole other story. However, they were all trained under Wild Bill Donovan in OSS in World War II, and evolved out of that into what Truman declared and organized the Central Intelligence Agency as sort of the black bag, back box operation. We all know the history of Central Intelligence Agency. Here we are today with, in effect, a coup of the CIA itself, a reverse coup, if you will, in the last 2 months or last month as a result of the recent election, so that all of the so-called old Cold War warrior heroes from a CIA perspective basically have been thrown out because they basically objected to what Bush had to say, which sort of leads me to what I'm trying to gather as the conclusion of our meetings. What are we learning by these presentations and going over major parts of history? One point that Woody made during the break was the new bumper sticker I hope he publishes, which says propaganda works. I think it's very true. Propaganda does work. So many movements that we've thought of, in particular Upton Sinclair EPIC, early in the year of 32 when the election was, which has started in February, everyone thought Upton Sinclair was going to win. No question by June, July, he was going to win. Guess what? He lost in November because of the massive impact of media. It was Knight and the Oakland Tribune people primarily and others, but we can look at Schwarzenegger's impact on the election of the propositions this last time. We can look at how the insidious way that Bush has been manipulating his so-called cultural values issues throughout the United States through the megaphone of his media control, which basically completely transcended all the self-interest issues that motivated people who otherwise would have voted for Kerry because of their own personal self-interest, turned out running for Bush in many cases on these cultural values. It shows that propaganda works, number one, and that power works, number two. think my prediction going forward is a self-destruct scenario by Mr. Bush. If you look back on Ronald Reagan, it was this is a second four-year term, was Iran-Contra scandal. If we look at Nixon, it wound up in Watergate. I was a McGovern delegate in 72, and McGovern was just beginning to talk about at the convention. And immediately thereafter, this whole scandal, as we know today, is Watergate. But at the time, going into the election, 72 election, no one thought of Watergate was on a front burner. There was little murmurings in the back rooms. You had to listen very closely to what was going on. But it turned out to be a completely new experience after the election that resulted in the resignation of Nixon. But you didn't see it coming. And I think we're in the same phase now. There are things out there, as Bush the first said when in a unguarded moment, you don't know half of what's going on. That's what Bush the first, the father, said. So you don't know half of what's going on. And just think about that for a minute, because it stuck with me all year, that other half that we don't know that's going on, we may well, in fact, know in the next period of time, which will lead to a major upheaval of Bush and his own, I won't say self-destruction, but certainly major, major castration, if I can use the word, of many of his efforts. But look at what happened in Nixon, Watergate. Look at the Reagan second term, Bush the first so-called second term, which never even happened, let alone he didn't even get elected. Many, many presidents in their second terms, to a degree, self-destruct. And I think we're going to see the same thing this time. I say hopefully, but I also think there's some historical basis behind it.
Yeah, and we don't, I mean, you got to be real careful about predictions because I always try to read the business pages of the LA Times and New York Times first in terms of the T-notes and bonds being bought by wealthy folks outside the country. I mean, if the Japanese and Chinese stop subsidizing our debt and our deficit, etc., I mean, who knows what could happen? A little here, a little here, a run on the money, a little of this, a little of that. And lots of things could unravel quite quickly. And of course, was he talking about only knowing half of what went on in his house or the country? I mean, what was? You don't know. You know, you can say, well, it appears that these things are going to be going on. But Woody, I guess somebody just said that another addition to the debt limit, and they've got to clearly. Somebody has to make an effort to get this budget under control. So, Deirdre?
I wanted to draw another analogy with Iran, along the lines of repression only working for a while. Under the Shah, the increasing power of SOVAK, the terror people felt. When I was there in 69, my sister-in-law, we'd be walking down the street, and I'd say something about, good gravy, the streets are full of potholes again. I thought they just fixed the streets. And she would say, shh, don't say anything. The grocer standing in the door of his shop over there could be a SOVAK agent. People believed that every taxi driver was a SOVAK agent. Tremendous fear and fear of being added to the list. When I went back in 78, I talked to some relatives in an outlying town of 20,000 in the mountains in the West, and said, I don't understand all this. People don't seem to be afraid anymore. And she said, at this point, there is not one family in the country who does not have someone they love in the Shah's torture prisons. No one is afraid anymore. And I'm thinking, as we watch the machine of repression grind faster and faster in this country, that we need to keep that in mind, that there is a point beyond which people will not allow things to go.
I was listening to John Pilger this morning, and he was talking about America's belief in its own exceptionalism. And I was drawing a parallel to that to Israel. I mean, there's a lot of parallels between America and Israel. I mean, in a sense, what was this saying about a land without a people, for a people without a land, you know? And we moved, you know, the settlers came to these shores to tame the new world where there wasn't anybody except for a few of these Indians running around. They obviously didn't know what they were doing. So, and the feeling of this kind of divinely inspired nation state. And it seems to be, if one has a belief in a higher power and an unfolding and there being a moral universe, it seems to be that the truth will out eventually. And the more that it's repressed and the more that people participate in the repression, it just grows and grows and grows and grows and grows. But the good news is that the more people become involved in the repression, like you were saying, nobody's afraid anymore because everybody's been touched by this.
And the other side of it is that the more Americans have access to news from other countries, the more we see that it's only us here who believe that, who can still believe in the exceptionalist idea of our nation. For everyone else, the emperor has no clothes anymore. The rest
but it
of the
depends.
World.
It depends on a couple of things. Some years ago, well, many years ago, in a speech he made, Martin Luther King quoted, I think it was the British writer, philosopher Thomas Carlyle, said, "The arc of the moral universe is long, but in the end it bends toward truth." If you look at, let's say, I mean, our journey in U.S. history, for all the contradictions and problems, much more of a closure between, let's say, the ideal sentiments of the Declaration of Independence today and, of course, in 1776, and that is owed to the grassroots struggle which brought that about. But in terms of how those of us in the United States and those outside the U.S. who have access to a far greater range of views. It's always ironic how we hear that. It always used to be about Cuba, especially. Well, they only get one side, right? These are the Cubans who were able to pick up Miami TV and all sorts of things. We almost never get anything directly from Cuba. The world's events do not explain themselves. They're always filtered through. It's like we see through our minds, not our eyes. So more and more in the world, the government, the regime here, is isolated and alienated from the world and hated at any time in U.S. history, and that even, I believe, even would conclude during the Vietnam War. But if people inside the country don't see it that way, then, of course, you can become even more insular that these people are trying to undermine our exceptionalism, our chosen path. We're righteous, they're not, they're evil, they're Satan, et cetera, et cetera. And that debate is going on in the country. There's no doubt about that. There are tens and tens and tens of millions of people who are deeply, deeply concerned about what the government's doing and what that makes the rest of us look like. And then there are people who clearly are closing the wagons, as it were, because they are so self-righteous that they are right and the rest of the world is wrong, that's a very dangerous possibility.
But what I wanted to say is I don't really know, and maybe somebody could throw some light on this, when people are so religious, which is not spiritual, that they believe that the other world is the prize, they won't ever be rational enough to even care when... They may even think that their child is a demon if they're thrown in jail. I just don't know how crazy these people get. People were burned as witches, and I feel as if we're in that similar kind of a climate. I can't conceive of what's going on in their mind, so that they are not interested at all in improving our lives here because it's only somewhere else. Their prize is elsewhere, and there's no point in expending any energy in making improvements here. And I don't know what you do in a case like this. And anyway, there's systemic problems, but you can't begin addressing them unless you have a rational electorate. You know, and so it really would pay to know what we're really dealing with here.
Well, I think we don't know exactly, but we do have some ideas in terms of what various leaders have said and some polling, well, I mean leaders in the sense that of the hardcore religious right, right? Roughly, I've seen estimated as a third of the supporters of Bush. I mean, very, very hardcore, very similar, by the way, in temperament and views to the hardcore Southern racists 40 years ago. I've been doing a lot of reading in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. And if you go back 40 years ago, 1964, okay, and the terms that were used then by whites who were under siege in the southern United States, and there was racism everywhere. As Malcolm X said, you know, the South starts at the Canadian border. He was right. But in terms of an outright terror regime, we're talking about Mississippi, Alabama, etc. 1964, black churches bombed, the Mississippi Three killed, etc. And then in Selma, our way of life threatened their way of life. They also were committed to American exceptionalism. They were the most religiously based people in the country by their avowed beliefs. They were what we would now call the religious right. We really didn't term them that way. They fought tooth and nail against any advances for black people in the South. It's the same core of people. I don't believe in reincarnation. Maybe some of them have come back. But the reason why you have to be careful about this is that, on the other hand, there are many, many people who are moved by spiritual and religious values in the country, who are deeply concerned about the environment and about justice and about equality, and progressive people, left people, secular people, atheists, whatever people may think of themselves, need to attempt to develop coalitions. But there are a core of people who could not be changed by reason and argument. That's why we had a civil war. They could not be changed in 1861. They could not be changed in 1964. They had to be moved. Remember what happened in the 60s to change this country. They had to use the force of law and at times federal troops to do that. And we're up against that now. They've shifted. That is, they can't be as overt as they were in 64 and bait black people. Okay? You can't get away with that today. You cannot get away with that publicly. So they can do that, though, against gay people. All right? So we're up against the same issue, and that it's a question of who is going to move whom. And the folks are not going to be moved by moral suasion, not that core, that's what I'm saying. And that's the hard core. And I would argue that's a neo-fascist core in this country. They were not moved in Germany, they were not moved in Italy. And so you gotta figure out some way, you gotta reach out to some people and somehow be able to isolate the others, because they, you know, if they had power, black people would still be slaves in this country. I mean, come on, let's face it here. And in 1855 and 1858 and 1860, they were still quoting the Bible and you know, the whites are this and blacks, you know, the hewers of wood and the drawers of water. The same folks. And whether Mississippi, Alabama, Wyoming, California, they're not all in the South, by the way. And so that issue will be settled in this country, and you want to try to figure out nonviolent ways of having it settled, but it has been never settled without the use of state power. Not once.
I get very frustrated when I think about exactly what you're talking about. But I think it's important to separate your own experience and what you're doing from what other people are doing. And, you know, there's that French philosopher, Teilhard de Chardin, who said that we're not human beings having a spiritual experience, we're spiritual beings having a human experience. And if you remember that what you can do is try and do everything you can to improve your life and the people that you touch with your life, then everything else will play out the way it's going to play out. It's not like we have necessarily the power to go out and change someone's mind. But maybe what we can do is, by sincerely being who we are and not being afraid of whatever it is that they're putting out, that when there is a moment of softness, and everybody has these moments, and if things get worse, as we've said that they might, you know, people are going to become disenchanted in Israel with the cruelty that they're perpetrating. People became disenchanted in this country with the cruelty that they were perpetrating against the blacks. And so those who wanted to continue that cruelty had to find new ways, more subtle ways, more socially acceptable ways to disguise their cruelty. And so all we can do is continue to shine the light and expose those darknesses. And when this idea of American exceptionalism plays itself out, and we go and we cause more suffering, and those of us who are committed to this kind of work, expose it and expose how long this has been going on throughout history. More and more people will become disenchanted, and you just need to be... It's almost like it takes more effort to hide yourself under a veil of fear than it does to open up to the light, because the light is always shining. And so in that moment of softness, when that light penetrates, they go, oh. And it doesn't matter who it is. It could be a Klansman, because there's people who are ex-Klansmen now who talk about having been that way and speaking against the Klan. So you can't pass judgment. All you can do is come from your own center and put out there and try and be as direct as possible and as loving as possible with people.
I wanted to comment in general about the successes of the so-called progressive efforts. In the 30s, we've got labor militancy, which basically revived and built labor unions in the 30s. What happened afterwards up to now is a whole other question. But the principle and the lesson to be learned was the effectiveness of union militancy, which was in the manufacturing sectors, automobiles and steel, et cetera, in the 30s, which we are experiencing now, at least the last 10 years, from the janitors, the hotel workers, the restaurant workers. So we have to look at some of those victories. The other victories was civil rights movement in the 64. John, you just alluded to what was going on in the Southern mentality in the 40s and 50s. The recently Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Lyndon Johnson, Master of the Senate, deals with the 40s and 50s and Lyndon Johnson's effort to get the Voting Rights Act passed in the late 50s and how he really got inside the Southern bloc of the Southern Democrats with the Richard Russell, et cetera, and how that was, the word is manipulated to get that election through. It was a victory in 1958 for, I think, Civil Rights Act, and in 64 for the Voting Rights Act, and then there was, 68, another Equality Act of some type. All those are major victories against a background of Emmett Till in the 50s and the publicity that adhered to that, as well as the whole civil rights movement in general. Along with that, in evolving out of the 60s, was the anti-war movement. Tremendous victory, I feel, in mobilizing American and, in effect, so-called the perception of splitting America in half with the anti-war movement. Right along with that was the whole question of the women's issues movement and the women's rights movement, which is strong with us to this very day, threatened, of course, by everything we see around us, but still massive gains the last 50 years of the women's movement, the nuclear power movement. We have eliminated nuclear power in the United States. If that effort was not made in the 60s in San Onofre and Diablo Canyon and all those demonstrations we went to and back east that John recalls, we would have nuclear power plants all over the United States today. Major victory when you think about nuclear power. Now, Bush is trying to revive it now, but it so far, it has not raised its ugly head. Look at what's happened with nuclear weapons in the last 40 years, 30 years. Even again, Bush trying to retract it, but in fact there's been a massive destruction and change of mutual assured destruction of missiles on both sides, et cetera, you know about nuclear weapons. We have had a number of major social benefits and successes that we have to look back on, learn from our successes, and repeat them.
That's one of the lessons of this book, in addition to the critique of what has happened in history in terms of exploitation, et cetera, the resistance of ordinary people. I mean, that's why Howard wrote this book. The resistance of ordinary people organized with a vision have made for positive changes that have affected all of our lives in this room for the better. I mean, you started with the Depression, incredible conditions that most of us in this country do not face. And even in those conditions, in the fields of California and New York, in upstate New York and Flint, Michigan, people organizing, struggling, made a difference. And that's really what changes history. I mean, that's the only way it happens.
Just got to add the most important one, which was in 1924, after 100 years of struggle, women received the right to vote. 100 years of struggle.
I'd just like to inject a little note that may sound cynical, but I was at a gathering during Thanksgiving, and someone said that the face of neo-fascism will look very different than what we understood to be fascism during World War II. And that is people sitting at Starbucks, business as usual, while the Fourth Amendment has been gone, search and seizure, Fifth Amendment, due process, gone, Sixth Amendment, right to confront your accuser, gone without a peep. A good half of the country just not alarmed at all about what's going on. And another half, another reality, that for any number of reasons sees things, maybe not this specifically, that are amiss. When we look at the anti-war movement of the 70s and the broad support it enjoyed, we need to remember that there was a core there too that had made connections, political connections, philosophical, ideological connections to what was going on, that did touch the concentric circles of support that spread out and eventually was generalized into a very wide protest against the Vietnam War. Those outer fringes were systematically dismantled during the 70s and 80s in very, very sophisticated ways that I think are unprecedented. And it's for that reason that I don't think one can deal with this strictly on a cognitive level, that one can argue that with people or persuade people. I think that's true. And I think that Klansmen can be persuaded or change colors, if you excuse the pun. But through the mass media, and I mean subliminally, the most sophisticated, the best and the brightest of psychologists, the most sophisticated marketing techniques have been used to persuade people, to work on people, to map people's brains, to figure out. It's not just this raw, crude, crass, right-wing radio, which certainly reinforces all of that. But unless we on the left appreciate those means of persuasion and are willing in some way to understand them and figure out ways to counteract them, I think those two realities will exist. My point is, I think it's unprecedented, the internalization of fascism. The brown shirts are not needed anymore. It's exquisite neo-fascism.
Maybe one final comment, because we're over.
It's really obvious that there are a lot of really, it just happened to me. I belong to a chorus group, and I'm sitting there talking about the election, and one guy gets up and says, "Why are you always bringing up these things, this political stuff? We're here to sing songs." I said, "Well, we're not singing now. We're just sitting around talking." "Well, you're always bringing up this stuff," and he starts screaming. And another guy says, we don't need him here. And so I'm getting up and I'm saying, well, what the hell? I don't have to be here. I'm just talking about something that's really happening. People start yelling. Then I left. And I went to a different meeting where they talk about current events, where you can talk about these things. I talked to the guy who runs the group, who was sitting there at the time. I called him up on the phone, said, "What do you think about this?" He says, "We can't even talk to you. I didn't want to talk to you." And that was the end of that. These people are, you're a radical. I don't even want to talk to you. It was unbelievable. And there's a lot of brainwashing that validating what you're talking about.
Well,
it happens to me all the time.
Is that right?
Exactly, right. But I keep doing it anyway.
On that note.
And I keep joining new groups.
All right, folks, thank you.
You have been listening to Dr. John Marciano's commentaries and discussions of Chapter 20, The 70s, Under Control, and Chapter 21, Carter, Reagan, Bush, The Bipartisan Consensus, from Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States. This recording from November 30th of 2004 is substituted for the recording of the group that met on January 17th of 2006. Every month, a group led by Dr. Marciano meets to discuss individual chapters. They meet at the Venice United Methodist Church Peace Center. To join the group, contact Dr. Marciano at 310-393-4815 or johnmarciano@macmac.com. This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We use the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share-alike 2.5 license to ensure the ongoing public availability of these recordings. We share them via the Internet, community radio, and CDs distributed through grassroots, social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be a part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. Contact us for copies of this program on CD. You can download it for free at radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. If you value what you heard in this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, and thus becoming yourself a part of a decentralized, democratic, civic media.